Chapter 2. The Age of Hysteria. In more than half of the severe cases of hysteria, obsessional neurosis, etc., which I have treated psychotherapeutically, I have been able to prove with certainty that the patient's father suffered from syphilis before marriage. I am of opinion that the coincidence I have observed is neither accidental nor unimportant. Sigmund Freud, Three Essays on the Theory of Sexuality, 1905. The Clue in Footnote 6. In the early 1890s, a prominent and wealthy Viennese manufacturer named Philipp Bauer was referred to a neuropathologist after suffering an attack of confusion, followed by symptoms of paralysis and slight mental disturbances. It didn't take long for the specialist, Sigmund Freud, to recognize the signs of syphilis, which Bauer acknowledged acquiring before marriage. While Freud is remembered for founding psychoanalysis, his academic training was in neurology and anatomy. As an intern at the Vienna General Hospital, he regularly saw male patients with syphilis in the dermatology ward. PP, for progressive paralysis, or GPI, is written in his own hand in the hospital's admission rolls. Freud prescribed Bauer an energetic course of anti-lutic, syphilitic treatment, as a result of which all the remaining disturbances passed off. In that era, such treatment could only have been mercury, and its energetic application probably involved both mercury inunctions, rubs, and injections of mercuric chloride. This fortunate intervention of mine, as Freud put it, so impressed Bauer that he brought his daughter, Ida, who had meanwhile grown unmistakably neurotic, and introduced her to Freud 4 years later. That visit did not lead to ongoing treatment, but 2 years after that, her condition had further deteriorated. She had become despondent, and wrote a note that her parents interpreted as suicidal. So in 1900, when Ida was almost 18, her father brought her back for psychotherapeutic treatment. She stuck with it for 3 months, a treatment course that became a turning point in the history of psychiatry. Freud changed her name to Dora and wrote about her in a case study formally titled Fragment of an Analysis of a Case of Hysteria, one of the foundational works of psychoanalysis and modern psychiatry. After Dora, writes Freud biographer Peter Gay, psychoanalytic technique was never the same. Freud attributed Dora's symptoms to emotional and sexual conflicts triggered by improper advances from Herr K., the family friend who accompanied her father on his initial visit to Freud. Also stirring the plot was Dora's belief, probably correct, that her father was having an affair with Herr K.'s wife. And Freud was more than a little suspicious that Dora had sexual feelings for the wife as well. But Freud may have missed something more important, the real reason for Dora's decline. The clue is in the epigraph at the top of the chapter and in footnote 6 to Dora. Now, a strikingly high, emphasis in original, percentage of patients I have treated psychoanalytically come of fathers who have suffered from TABIS, or general paralysis, GPI. In consequence of the novelty of my method, I see only the severest cases. Sometimes in medicine the truth can be found in a footnote, and this is a remarkable example. In that footnote, Freud describes the conclusion to which I have been driven by my experience as a neuropathologist, namely, that syphilis in the male parent is a very relevant factor in the etiology of the neuropathic constitution of children. But why? Syphilis is not inherited, though it can be contracted from the mother during birth, just like HIV. And while having a father with syphilis certainly could create psychological problems, and counseling could help resolve them, this does not seem to be Freud's argument. Furthermore, the symptoms these offspring developed go way beyond what Freud, in another case called commonplace emotional upheavals. On this, however, we agree with Freud. The connection was neither accidental nor unimportant. In the popular imagination, Victorian-era hysteria is perceived as the convenient fainting spells and histrionic behavior of upper-crust women. Most cultural historians believe that hysteria was triggered by the emerging conflict between female self-empowerment and traditional roles. "Hysterical is what men call women they can't control," says one scholar of German literature, and in modern parlance, that's a good definition. But as we shall see, both the mental and physical symptoms of clinically diagnosed hysteria were severe, and they were precisely defined. Dora had these symptoms, although not to the totally disabling extent of some other patients. According to Freud, when she was about 12, she began to suffer from hemicranial headaches in the nature of a migraine and from attacks of nervous coughing. The most troublesome symptom during the first half of an attack of this kind, at all events, in the last few years, used to be a complete loss of voice. Other signs and symptoms included piercing gastric pains and sometimes dragging her right foot. Now let's look at the timing of Dora's troubles and her father's treatment for syphilis. Dora was about 12 when her father saw Freud for neurosyphilis and was given an energetic course of what was undoubtedly mercury. Who tended him? Dora. "The nature of her disposition has always drawn her towards her father," Freud wrote, "and his numerous illnesses were bound to have increased her affection for him. In some of these illnesses, he would allow no one but her to discharge the lighter duties of nursing." It gives an entirely new meaning to transference if the treatment Freud prescribed for the father inadvertently poisoned Dora as she nursed him in his sick bed. All her symptoms, headaches, persistent cough, trouble walking and talking, gastric crises, depression, are also symptoms of mercury poisoning, and reminiscent of Kreppelin's description of GPI itself. And their appearance entirely coincides with her involvement with her father's treatment. Rereading Freud with this in mind, his psychosexual explanations for Dora's symptoms seem even less plausible. Consider her persistent cough, or tussis nervosa, as Freud called it. He believed it represented her obsession with her father's probable affair with Frau K. and the thought of them having oral sex. The conclusion was inevitable. She pictured to herself a scene of sexual gratification, per os, by mouth, between the two people whose love affair occupied her mind incessantly. She also felt the residual trauma of Herr K.'s attempt to molest her, and, according to Freud, declared that she could still feel upon the upper part of her body the pressure of Herr K.'s embrace. "I believe that during the man's passionate embrace she felt not merely his kiss upon her lips, but also the pressure of his erect member against her body. This perception was revolting to her. It was dismissed from her memory, repressed, and replaced by the innocent sensation of pressure upon her thorax, which in turn derived an excessive intensity from its repressed source. Once more, therefore, we find a displacement from the lower part of the body to the upper." Dora may well have been revolted by Herr K.'s behavior and distressed by images of her father's possible affair, but the constellation of severe physical and mental symptoms Freud attributes to that distress seems unlikely. We are hardly the first to take issue with the good doctor. Poking holes in Freudian theory has become sport. Under relentless attack for decades, many of his theoretical foundations have since crumbled. But while we propose that mercury poisoning may have caused some of Freud's most formative cases, we do not mean to dismiss everything that has followed as folly. Recent research has begun to suggest quantifiable benefits from intensive and long-term psychodynamic therapy, as psychoanalysis is now known. Nor is the idea of toxic exposure among Freud's cases a fringe proposition. Another patient, Anna O., whose symptoms were similar to, but much more pronounced than Dora's, is considered the very first case in psychoanalytic literature. In the 1984 anthology, Anna O., 14 Contemporary Reinterpretations, one essayist wrote, "In considering a speculative, retrospective diagnosis, I believe one cannot exclude the possibility of a toxic psychosis, perhaps based on a morphine-opium addiction." Anna had used these drugs to overcome severe facial pain, and this conjecture came from the director of the Chicago Institute for Psychoanalysis, a past president of the American Psychoanalytic Association. Nothing fringe about him. Once you begin looking, clues to possible mercury toxicity are everywhere in Freud's cases. Take Frau K., who was probably having an affair with Dora's father. Their acquaintance with the K's had begun before her father's serious illness, but it had not become intimate until the young woman, Frau K., had officially taken on the position of nurse during that illness, while Dora's mother had kept away from the sick room, Freud recounts. But as the families became friends, the nurse-patient role ended. And while previously Frau K. had been an invalid and had even been obliged to spend months in a sanatorium for nervous disorders because she had been unable to walk, she had now become a healthy and lively woman. While the chronology is not precisely detailed, Frau K.'s involvement in nursing, her severe mental and physical problems, and her remarkable recovery when her nursing role ended, may be clues to the cause of Dora's problems as well. The idea that mercury could have triggered the clinical symptoms of hysteria in his patients was not a connection Freud ever seems to have made, even though toxic hysteria had been written about since the mid-1800s. 5 years before Freud saw Dora, Intoxications et Hysterie by Camille Henry Hishman included a specific account about what was believed to be the relation of hysteria to chronic poisoning by lead, alcohol, and mercury. Freud had the book in his personal library. It is strange that he could miss the possibility when he himself almost certainly prescribed mercury to Dora's father and noted that she took care of him. But by the time Freud was treating her father, his mind was focused on other possibilities that soon came to dominate his thinking. The stigmata. Almost 40 years before Freud treated Philip Bauer, Louis Pasteur's germ theory of 1862 heralded the beginning of modern medicine and led to the discovery of penicillin in the 1920s. The stunning insight that microorganisms were responsible for much of human illness. The decisive use of penicillin against syphilis in the 1940s was followed by many other antibiotics, medicines, and medical techniques. But the most immediate application of germ theory was in antisepsis, preventing infection in wounds created by injury or surgery. In England, Joseph Lister read Pasteur and had the insight to apply his ideas to surgery. The first antiseptic treatment was carbolic acid, first used in 1867. It saved the life of the first surgical patient Lister used it on. Lister wrote about its success in the prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, in 1867, and carbolic acid was soon in wide use. This was a revolution in surgery and saved the lives of countless people. Antiseptic treatment competes with penicillin as one of the great accomplishments of medicine. Lister and others were soon looking for better antiseptics, and they quickly found that mercury did a great job in preventing bacterial growth. So as antiseptic use spread like wildfire across European hospitals in the 1870s, so did an entirely new application for mercuric chloride, the inorganic, water-soluble mercury salt, also known as corrosive sublimate, and Van Swieten's liquor. While it had previously been used for treating syphilis, it was now widely adopted in surgery for dressing of bandages, as a spray in the operating room, and even for household use as a cleaning agent and disinfectant. In 1881, Robert Koch reported that low concentrations of mercuric chloride were effective as an antiseptic, and gave the stamp of approval to mercuric chloride solutions, such as Van Swieten's liquor. One commentator described its adoption as universal. Lister himself wrote an enthusiastic review in 1884. With Koch's and Lister's endorsements, the use of mercury in Europe multiplied greatly from the 1870s on. Doctors and nurses slathered on mercury-based creams to treat skin conditions, including the sores of syphilis. Injections of mercuric chloride were used in syphilis wards. Physicians and nurses dipped their hands in it to kill germs. So did housewives and cleaning staff. Inevitably, many people simply came into contact with too much of a toxic chemical. In other words, they got poisoned by the exposure to so much mercuric chloride, the most toxic form of mercury yet known, far more toxic than simple rubs or elemental mercury and calomel, the other common mercury formulation. In effect, Van Sweeten's liquor, the most popular solution containing mercuric chloride, had spilled from the bottle marked for syphilis only into a much wider population of patients, not to mention those who treated and cared for them. The law of unintended and unseen consequences was about to be applied on a tragic scale. In October 1885, 7 years before his sessions with Dora, Freud arrived in Paris to study with the greatest neurologist of his day, the father of modern neurology, Jean-Martin Charcot. Charcot presided over the Salpêtrière, the vast combination of poorhouse, madhouse, and hospital rolled into one. Freud came to Paris on the heels of what might have been a career-ending disaster for a less resilient professional. In Über Coca, published earlier the same year, Freud had extolled the virtues of cocaine while completely missing its addictive and toxic effects. He even thought it could wean someone safely off a morphine addiction. In truth, it simply led to a potentially fatal double addiction. Ultimately, he missed cocaine's one useful property as a local anesthetic for eye surgery. Freud desperately wanted to be famous. To that end, he seemed to have a weakness for medical figures who already were. Perhaps he took their very prominence as evidence of perfection. Witness Freud's report on Charcot. The man who is at the head of all these resources and auxiliary services is now 60 years of age. He exhibits the liveliness, cheerfulness, and formal perfection of speech which we are in the habit of attributing to the French national character, while at the same time he displays the patience and love of work which we usually claim for our own nation. The attraction of such a personality soon led me to restrict my visits to one single hospital and to seek instruction from one single man. Significantly, Charcot had also treated general paralysis of the insane and was starting to study another group, patients whose symptoms mimicked those of GPI, coughs, paralysis, and other baffling problems, but who did not have syphilis. These, we suspect, were examples of mercury exposure or other toxic effects without synergistic and fatal involvement of the syphilis bacterium. Charcot changed Freud's life. The 6 months he spent in Paris were one of the pivotal experiences of Freud's career and set him on the path to fame and glory, toward the great, great nimbus of admiration he acknowledged seeking. That made Charcot's influence crucial not just to neurology, but to psychiatry as well. Charcot had become a medical intern at the Salpêtrière in 1848. The immense complex, capped by a dome, was built in 1634 to store saltpeter, an element in the making of gunpowder. In 1656, Louis XIV had turned it into the female branch of the Paris Hôpital Général, where it also housed many of the poor and indigent of the city. It soon became the largest charitable center of its kind in Europe. In Charcot's heyday, it housed some 5,000 patients and developed an equally busy outpatient practice. This was a gold mine for a researcher interested in neurology. Inmates and patients presented all kinds of ailments, and because they lived in the facility, they died there too. Thus, their brains were then available to be autopsied. A well-known sketch shows Charcot in profile, wearing a top hat and holding a brain in his hands. Charcot ultimately returned in 1862 to become a professor of pathological anatomy at the hospital. Building on that specialty, his pioneering approach was described as anatomoclinical, a method that consisted of describing and classifying signs of individual disorders, and then, on autopsy, connecting those symptoms to particular parts of the brain that showed lesions or anomalies. And he was brilliant at it. Over the next two decades, Charcot discovered Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and many other maladies, and presided over a cadre of gifted physicians who lent their names to other crucial discoveries, Tourette and Babinski among them. In 1870, the hospital was reorganized and Charcot became responsible for outpatients as well as those who lived at the Salpêtrière. This opened his eyes to a disorder that until then he had paid almost no heed. In his numerous publications before 1870, he showed little interest in it. Then, on October 12, 1878, he gave his first lecture on what he called hystero-epilepsy. Hysteria ended up as an impossibly vast diagnostic catch-all for diseases that nobody could figure out. But as Peter D. Kramer writes in Freud, Invention of the Modern Mind, the term first referred to patients who showed neurological symptoms, such as epileptic seizures or paralysis of a limb, without having the underlying brain or nerve damage that would explain the symptom. But mood disorders, hallucinations, and simply eccentric behavior, especially by women, could also be deemed hysterical. Charcot considered a number of these hypotheses. A hereditary neurological weakness that could be triggered by a physical trauma. Unconscious ideas. Hypnosis seemed to confirm they contributed to the expression of hysteria. Even sexual problems. Charcot is reputed to have told Freud at a dinner party that one woman's hysteria was due to her husband's sexual inadequacy and that it is la chose génitale toujours, toujours, toujours. In 1880, Charcot had begun taking pictures of his hysteria patients, perhaps the first systematic depiction in photographs of a clinical syndrome. The photos were fascinating, the symptoms were bizarre, and his lectures soon drew large crowds. Indeed, by the time Freud arrived, Charcot had established himself as a showman as well as a precise medical practitioner. His showcase was the weekly Tuesday lecture in which he exhibited his hysteria patients. These collectively came to be known as his Salle des Hystériques. The huge amphitheater was filled to the last place with a multicolored audience drawn from tout Paris, authors, journalists, leading actors and actresses, fashionable demi-mondaines, wrote an author who was frequently present. The show began as, one by one, patients were brought on stage and discussed, mostly women. Some had strange contractures, while others went into fits on command. There were patients who shook, made strange noises, and adopted seemingly impossible positions, their heads on one chair, their feet on another, their torsos suspended in air but stiff as a board. Others formed the Arc de Cercle, in which their heads and feet touched the ground and their bodies made a semicircle like a performer from Cirque du Soleil. Charcot induced some of these bizarre effects on command through hypnosis, then in vogue and believed to reveal a deep hidden layer of the psyche. Ever the clinician, Charcot carefully described and diagrammed his patient's problems and formulated what he called the stigmata of hysteria. These were the central cluster of symptoms, contractures, visual field constriction, and loss of feeling in various parts of the body, often on one side, a condition known as hemianesthesia. The word stigmata was meant to refer to the permanent symptoms of hysteria, as opposed to the seizures and trances that came and went. Charcot was a popular figure, So in order to give his Tuesday lectures a broader audience, they were compiled into multi-volume texts that were translated from the original French language and sold all over the world. In one such text, the third volume contains references to hysteria everywhere. Perhaps the most striking impression one gets in paging through the volume, however, is a visual one. Charcot's discussions of hysteria are anchored by a notably large number of charts, what the publishers called woodcuts, documenting the hysterical stigmata. Ophthalmic charts, showing the restricted visual fields of his hysteria cases. Full-body charts, highlighting zones of anesthesia, where patients experienced a loss of sensation, and drawings of palsied and contracted limbs. Charcot clearly believed that the stigmata were so unique and distinctive in terms of defining the core of the disease that he took great pains to illustrate them visually. The overall impression of a modern observer, not wedded to any preconceptions, is that something quite real was wrong with most of these patients. The problem with Charcot's theory of hysteria was his assumption that simply because 19th-century neurologists couldn't pinpoint an organic cause, one did not exist. The classic case of Charcot's hysteria was a man Charcot called Lelogue blank. In October 1885, the same month Freud came to Paris, Lelogue blank, a florist's deliveryman, was knocked unconscious by a carriage while pushing his wheelbarrow. Taken to a hospital, he remained in a coma for several days. 6 months later, he was transferred to the Salpêtrière, his legs nearly paralyzed, his memory impaired, the corner of his mouth twitching. Charcot decided Lelogue blank, who also exhibited the so-called stigmata, was suffering from hysteria. He deduced that while the initial impact of the accident was real enough, the fact that he continued to experience symptoms was based on fear triggered by the accident. Today, post-traumatic stress disorder is considered a credible psychiatric condition. Though a traumatic event may remain safely in the past, the patient's memory of it continues to elicit panic and anxiety, which may express itself in any number of ways. Charcot's hypothesis about Lelogue blank seems a similar concept, a kind of post-traumatic injury disorder, to explain the patient's continuing symptoms. But Charcot dismissed the fact that Lelogue blank had sustained a physical injury, rather than simply an emotionally traumatic one. To conclude that continuing symptoms were merely emotional was an unjustified leap. It suggests a complete lack of understanding on the part of Charcot of what would now be readily diagnosed as a closed head injury. This is additionally surprising, given that Charcot had otherwise made astute neurological discoveries based on physical investigations of the brain. From this, Freud scholar Richard Webster writes, "We may derive a conclusion which is both simple and terrible in its implications. Lelogue blank, the classic example of a patient who supposedly suffered from traumatic hysteria, did not forget. Amnesia was one of his major symptoms, because he was frightened. He forgot because he was concussed. His various symptoms were not produced by an unconscious idea. They were the result of brain damage." While anyone who looks at the Lelogue case today can clearly see the error of Charcot's ways, we believe similar clues have remained hidden in many of Charcot's other cases. For much the same reason, they have stayed submerged in Freud's Dora. The physical trauma of being hit by a carriage is plain to see, and allows us to draw new and very different conclusions based on modern understanding of the brain. But the impact of a toxic exposure was, and remains, less obvious. Mercury and other toxins often left the victim every bit as disabled, but with no eyewitness to identify the culprit. Perhaps Charcot's most famous female case was a nurse named Justine Echeverry, known as Etch blank in print. Before she became ill, Etch was a nurse at the main hospital in Bordeaux. She was nearly raped, and her subsequent descent into a nervous state and then a convulsive attack 1 year later at the age of 25 were attributed to the sexual assault. Afterward, she worked at a children's hospital in Paris, but suffered repeated and more frequent convulsions, urinary retention, paralyses, and other complications. Again, symptoms entirely compatible with occupational mercury exposure. It seems logical that harmful effects of mercury were as much a hazard of nursing in the later 19th century as being hit by a carriage was a hazard of working as a deliveryman. The arm and hand contractures mirror earlier accounts of palsy of the hands in those who rubbed on mercurial ointment, even when wearing gloves. Many other patients of Charcot had backgrounds that obviously implicated mercury as the culprit. But once the theory of hysteria had taken hold of the confident and accomplished neurologist, this explanation was continuously ignored or overlooked. Charcot describes a hospital attendant treated for abdominal pains, a right hemianesthesia, who, one morning, on getting up, he had fallen to the ground, without loss of consciousness, but had been unable to speak for 48 hours. But misses the fact that he was in the same line of work as H. Blank, and had similar hysterical symptoms. Charcot wrote of another patient with clear evidence of mercury toxicity. Gil Blank, 32 years old, a metal gilder, was admitted into the Salpêtrier in January 1885. Earlier in the same year, Freud studied with Charcot. His occupation, in which mercury is employed, has never produced any symptoms which can be connected with mercurial poisoning. There are no signs of alcoholism, no syphilis. His first attack, seizure, took place at the age of 20, without known cause. He was outside an omnibus when he felt the first warnings. He had time to descend, and the convulsive attack took place on the street. After this, the attacks came on rather frequently. He reckoned about 4 or 5 a month. Charcot assumed that routine mercury exposure under the rudimentary precautions of the day couldn't possibly be toxic, absent some calamitous accident. Yet Gil Blank's job put him in direct contact with a substance known to cause the symptoms he experienced. In hindsight, these seizures were likely the result. It wasn't just mercury that Charcot missed or dismissed. He also misinterpreted the true cause of an analogous condition known as carbon disulfide hysteria, the result of workers' exposure to the toxin in rubber vulcanization factories. Its cause and symptoms, which were well known by the mid-1800s, included headaches, muscle weakness, body numbness, and insomnia, as well as deficits of memory, confusion, and even mania. But Charcot was having none of it when he presented a glaring case of carbon disulfide poisoning on November 6, 1888. The patient, a worker in one of the vulcanization plants, was knocked out by fumes, comatose for half an hour, and in bed for 2 days. Afterward, he continued to exhibit classic symptoms of decreased sensation, twitching, and vision loss. What did Freud's mentor deduce from all this? A doctor recently observed, to Charcot, all this could only mean one thing. They had before them an unfortunate victim with all of the classic manifestations of hysteria. Here, Charcot's clinical misinterpretation of carbon disulfide intoxication becomes most clearly illuminated, highlighting profound flaws in the presumptions of hysteria. Instead of considering the evidence at hand, Charcot's observations bent reality to make it conform to the preset demands of the diagnosis he needed to make. By the end of his life, Charcot had become even more extreme. His approach could be described as uberhysteria. In a textbook on nervous diseases by Francis Xavier Dercoum, published in 1895, the author, reflecting medical consensus, states that the toxic tremors are those caused by arsenic, mercury, lead, copper, and alcohol. But not so according to Charcot. Shortly before his death, he began to teach very positively that mercurial tremor was always hysterical, and he based his conclusions on the sudden recoveries and the frequent presence of his so-called hysterical stigmata, namely, concentric limitations of the field of vision, an emotional condition, and seemingly erratic impairments of sensation. But the reverse is true. Mercury tremors and the characteristic constriction of the visual field are always not hysterical. The core symptoms of Charcot's so-called stigmata that he ascribed to hysteria, along with seizures and mental disturbances, were actually evidence of poisoning, most often by mercury. The tragedy for Charcot, as well as for Freud and many more who followed, is that he was observant, and he correctly interpreted hysteria as a disease of the nerves. But despite the great contribution he made to neurology, he was deeply confused both about the origins of the disease and its treatment. In the midst of the most widespread daily exposure to mercury in human history, he dealt with its victims on a daily basis and missed its impact entirely. Freud returned to Vienna on a contact high from his few months with Charcot, and on October 15, 1886, presented his mentor's theories on male hysteria at a meeting of the Vienna Society of Medicine. By all accounts, the event was not the epic-making triumph he envisioned. Freud felt he was met with rejection by the hidebound Viennese medical establishment. In truth, the concept that men as well as women could be hysterics was nothing new at the time, and what Freud took to be contempt was actually indifference. Regardless, Freud set out to find an actual case that matched Charcot's criteria. Freud found him through a laryngologist. The patient was a 29-year-old man he called August P. 3 years before, August P. had begun suffering from a panoply of symptoms, including ringing in the ears, left-sided headaches, pressure inside his cranium, violent heart palpitations, convulsions, and loss of sensation on one side of his body, hemianesthesia. In addition to penning his own case study, Freud had an ophthalmologist friend, Leopold Königstein, write up a separate piece on August P.'s vision problems. Freud's and Königstein's papers were published in consecutive issues of the Wiener Medizinische Wochenschrift, a Viennese medical journal, in December 1886. Both articles exist in a bound volume in Freud's archive in London, where he fled following Germany's annexation of Austria in 1938, and died the next year. The contents of the volume are written in Freud's own hand on the first blank page. When we visited the archive, the director, Michael Molnar, turned the pages of the rare text for us, and when he came to Königstein's article, we were suddenly staring at the same type of visual field constriction chart we had seen so many times in Charcot's cases. August P. had been an engraver, which suggested he experienced the same kind of occupational exposure to mercury and or other metals seen in many of the hysteria patients Charcot diagrammed. Freud, it seems, had learned so well from his mentor, he was doomed to repeat his mistake. Tunnel vision. Josef Breuer, despite being credited by Freud for originating psychoanalysis, is perhaps the most forgotten person in the history of psychiatry. In July 1880, a young woman named Bertha Pappenheim, Breuer called her Anna O., using initial letters that preceded those of her real name, fell sick while tending her father during a sudden illness. Her symptoms were both bizarre and diverse. From severe visual field constriction, tremors, contractures, and hallucinations, including hallucinations of absence in which only Breuer would be visible to her in a room full of people, to inexplicable speech disruptions. Although the family was Jewish and anti-Semitism was on the rise, the Pappenheims had acculturated to the point that they spent summers at the same Austrian spa village as Prince Leopold of Bavaria. During the summer of 1880, The family vacation turned into a nightmare when Anna's father, a grain merchant, fell ill with what was described as a parapleuritic abscess, probably a pulmonary complication of tuberculosis, then sweeping Vienna. A surgeon was called from the capital, and as Anna waited for him, sitting at her father's bedside, she had the first of her symptoms. Her right arm became paralyzed, and she hallucinated snakes coming out of her fingernails. Her father's health never recovered, and she faithfully attended him upon the family's return to Vienna. But her symptoms worsened and were joined by a relentless cough. During the last few months of his illness, she herself was barred from the sick room and sometimes confined to bed. Broyo was called in to treat the cough. He may also have been the family physician, and, given her florid mental symptoms, he diagnosed the cough as hysterical, a tussis nervosa, the same symptom Freud later diagnosed in Dora. After that, a series of severe disorders that were apparently, emphasis in original, quite new, developed in quick succession. Pains at the back of her head, a complaint that the walls are falling in, paresis of the front neck muscles, contracture and anesthesia of the right upper and, after some time, of the right lower extremity. There were also problems with speech, similar to Dora's but worse, for as the contractures developed, a deep functional disorganization of speech set in. The first thing that became noticeable was that she could not find words, and gradually this became worse. Then her speech lost all grammatical structure. The syntax was missing, as was the conjugation of verbs, so that in the end she was using only infinitives that were incorrectly formed from a weak past participle. And no articles. As the disorder developed, she could find almost no words at all. Most remarkable, perhaps, were the ways in which her sight was affected. There was high degree restriction of the field of vision. Looking, with delight, at a bunch of flowers, she could only ever see one flower at a time. She complained that she could not recognize people, that she used to be able to recognize faces without having to think about it and work at it. Broya treated Anna O. with hypnosis and also began to interview her deeply. Over the next few months, Anna's symptoms worsened dramatically till she was unable to eat. But as Breuer talked with her about her problems and spent several hours a week with her, he thought he noticed something. When they hit on what appeared to be an association between a symptom and some event in the past, the symptoms seemed to diminish and even disappear. The first and most dramatic example was that despite her thirst, Anna had stopped drinking water, getting liquid only by sucking on fruit. But one day she mentioned her disgust that someone had let a dog drink from a glass of water intended for humans, and soon after that, she took her first sip of water. This has been described as the moment when psychoanalysis, or as Anna called it, the talking cure, began. It was also around the time when mercuric chloride began coming into use as an antiseptic. The onset of Anna's symptoms on the evening when she waited by her father's bed for the surgeon to arrive and treat an abscess that was possibly mercuric chloride-soaked may be far more meaningful than their apparent improvement when she mentioned a dog drinking out of a water glass. One problem with Breuer's approach is that despite the fact he and Freud declared the Anna O. case a complete success, it was no such thing. Anna stayed in a sanitarium for 2 years and continued having evening hallucinations for several years more. Toxic relationships. It is remarkable how closely the symptoms of hysteria fit mercury poisoning in particular and toxic exposures more broadly. For example, the product label for thimisoral, the ethyl mercury preservative still used in medical products, is a virtual summary of hysterical stigmata. Early signs of mercury poisoning in adults are nervous system effects, including narrowing of the visual field and numbness in the extremities. These effects and many more, as we've noted, were well described by the time Charcot, Freud, and Breuer overlooked or ignored them in pursuit of grand unified psychiatric theories. But the focus had almost always been on the patient receiving mercury treatments, not on the caregiver. Intermittent reports did arise of hazards common in caregiving professions. A 20th century survey of mercury exposure noted chronic mercury intoxication remained an occupational hazard for physicians who treated syphilis by rubbing mercury inunctions on their skin. The 1925 report, Industrial Poisons in the United States, ran through a wide range of mercury's exposures and described its effect on a physician who had to resort to applying a mercurial rub without gloves. Not long after he began this, he had three violent attacks of abdominal pain closely resembling lead colic. Almost as striking as these words, a description that sounds like Dora's gastric pains, are their placement. In the middle of a discussion of occupational mercury exposures of workers ranging from hatters to miners to dentists. Caregivers fit right in. They breathed the fumes, changed the bedding and bandages, washed their hands in mercuric chloride solutions, and rubbed on mercury. Yet these exposures went largely unnoticed because in so many cases those caregivers were unpaid and unpedigreed, and they were women. They were Dora and Anna O., the daughters of the affluent, taking care of their ailing parents. This was part of the job description for young women of their station and their day. Other mercury exposure symptoms described in Industrial Poisons are worth noting as well. Delirium with hallucinations, intense tremor, clonic spasms, followed by paresis, mental torpor, and loss of memory. Sometimes insomnia is the chief complaint, or bad dreams, or depression, despondency, loss of memory, melancholia with suicidal tendency, even manic depressive insanity. Given this virtual cheat sheet of hysteria symptoms, why didn't the medical profession pick up on the adverse consequences of this caregiver effect? As we heard in Chapter 1, mainstream doctors were in denial over the consequence for the very patients they were treating with mercury. Deducing in 1900 that Dora, for example, might be suffering second-hand effects of the same toxin that was causing symptoms in her father would be like expecting tobacco companies in the 1930s to have acknowledged the dangers of second-hand smoke. Yet, such denials were a subject of controversy even in the heyday of mercury treatments. We found one searing indictment of the abuse of mercury in an 1847 essay in England's Provincial Journal by Robert Storrs, Esquire, Surgeon, Doncaster. Mercury has long been known to be an active and frequent cause of paralysis in its various employment in arts and manufactures, or in the working of minds from which it is obtained. But its power of producing remotely paralytic diseases has been seldom alluded to. We often flatter ourselves with the supposition of having been able to shorten the course of this or that disease by the promptitude of our treatment, frequently including in that treatment the exhibition of this drug. But we might moderate our exultation were we able to look back upon the ruined constitutions, the disabled limbs, or the shortened lives, which a rash, prolonged, or sometimes even uncalled-for use of this active mineral has produced. These are painful reflections, but they must have occurred to almost every conscientious practitioner in the solitude of the closet or in the silence of the night, when we are but too apt to magnify our errors or to exalt the successes of others. We will, however, dismiss this unwelcome train of thought, satisfied that such reflections are often productive of beneficial warnings. About the same time Freud prescribed his energetic treatment to Dora's father, Dr. H. H. Hopp published an article in the Cincinnati Lancet Clinic. He wrote, "In the female, hysteria is found more frequently in the so-called better classes, in the wealthy, the cultured, the refined, those who occupy comfortable and easy positions in life. In men, it is the opposite. Its more frequent subject is the working man, the hard toiler. That's a pretty good description of Dora and Anna O, of August P. and Gil Blank. Sigmund Freud and Josef Breuer were friends and colleagues in the medical milieu of Vienna in the 1880s, and Breuer told Freud about his talking cure of Anna O. Freud described the case and its seemingly successful outcome to Charcot in 1885, but, wedded to hypnosis and his anatomical approach to hysteria, the Parisian urologist was uninterested. Still, Freud saw in Breuer's radical treatment a new path, and he took up the talking cure with a passion. Together, Breuer and Freud wrote A Preliminary Communication in 1893. They proposed an ambitious theory of hysteria. From now on, courtesy of Anna O, and her amazing response, the hysterical stigmata designated by Charcot would have a psychogenic basis. Hysteria was triggered by a strong idea, a traumatic moment, a conversation in which the unwanted thought, emotion, or instinct was submerged, and physical and mental symptoms emerged in their place. Resurrecting the trauma and its associated emotions under the skillful guidance of the psychoanalyst would eliminate the symptoms and restore the patient's health. In 1895, Breuer and Freud published Studies in Hysteria, which began with the story of Fräulein Anna O. These are the case histories that launched Freud and the whole of psychoanalysis, as well as the ideas that came to dominate not just psychiatry, but intellectual discourse, the arts, and our understanding of sexuality. Breuer soon parted company with Freud. He thought Freud's belief in the early sexual roots of most adult problems was ridiculous. If Pasteur began the modern age of medicine, Freud launched the modern age of culture, and there may have been far more of a connection between their discoveries than anybody has realized. Commonplace emotional upheavals. Among the five case histories in Studies in Hysteria, Elizabeth von R. stands out for exhibiting absolutely no emotional problems. Her legs just hurt. In autumn 1892, a colleague and friend of mine asked me to examine a young lady who had suffered from pains in her legs for more than 2 years and had difficulties walking. Freud begins. On making this request, he added that he thought that this was a case of hysteria, even though none of the usual signs of neurosis could be found. Elizabeth told Freud a fairly large, ill-defined area on the front of the right thigh was indicated as the focus of the pains. The affliction had developed gradually over the last 2 years and varied greatly in intensity. It turned out that Elizabeth was also nursing a loved one. Their father had hidden, or perhaps overlooked, a chronic heart complaint. One day he was brought home unconscious after his first attack of pulmonary edema. He was nursed for the next 18 months, and throughout this time, Elizabeth made sure that she had first place at his bedside. She slept in her father's room, woke at night when he called, watched over him by day. This period of nursing had to be connected with the beginning of her illness, for she could remember that during the last 6 months of the nursing, she had been confined to bed for a day and a half because her right leg was so painful. In fact, it was not until 2 years after the death of her father that she felt ill and that her pains prevented her from walking. Although the doctor who referred her believed the pains were hysterical, he could not pinpoint their psychological cause. For the doctor, the patient's confession, description of her life, was at first a great disappointment. It was, after all, a case history made up of commonplace emotional upheavals, which explained neither why the person concerned should necessarily fall ill with hysteria, nor why the hysteria had assumed precisely this form. Undaunted, Freud pressed ahead. When he got nothing through an attempt at hypnosis, he used the trick of applying pressure to her head. This I implemented by demanding that the patient tell me, without fail, what appeared to her inner eye or drifted through her memory at the moment of pressure. She was silent for a long time, then, at my insistence, confessed that she had thought of an evening on which a young man had accompanied her home after a party, of the conversations that had occurred between the two of them, and of the feelings with which she then returned home to care for her father. And the painful legs? At last, Elizabeth recalled something that immediately suggested the explanation to him. This was, in fact, the place where her father's leg rested every morning, while she replaced the bandages which bound up his severely swollen leg. This must have happened 100 times, and yet, strangely enough, she had not thought of this connection until today. Finally, Freud had linked a somatic symptom to its presumed source in her emotional conflict. Elizabeth could not, figuratively speaking, get up and walk away from her obligation to her father, as much as her libido might be telling her to do so. The sensation embodying that reality was her father's bandages touching her thigh as she changed them. Freud concluded, "In this way the painful area had, first, grown by apposition, in that each new theme, which had a pathogenic effect, occupied a new region of the legs. Secondly, each of these scenes that made a powerful impression left behind a trace by establishing a permanent and constantly increasing cathexis of the various functions of the legs, a linking of these functions with the sensation of pain. But yet, a third mechanism had unmistakably been collaborating in the formation of the astasia abasia. As a literary device, this works beautifully, and some have wisely pointed out that psychoanalysis has more in common with literature than with science. In the non-fiction world of 1892, however, those bandages, Elizabeth must have changed 100 times, would likely have been soaked, and the father's wounds cleansed with the universal antiseptic of the day, mercuric chloride. Repeated exposure is very probably why her pains radiated from there." Freud did pause to muse about the connection between nursing and hysteria, puzzling over its frequency. Experience shows that nursing, ill family members, and strong sexual feelings also play the main role in most of the more closely analyzed case histories of hysterics. He and Breuer write. Why? There are good reasons why nursing should play such a significant role in the prehistory of hysterias, Freud said. Indeed, there is clear evidence of a series of factors that are operative in this. Disturbance of one's physical state by interrupted sleep, neglect of one's physical well-being, and the repercussions of continually gnawing anxiety on the vegetative functions. But that, he went on to say, was a little too obvious. What is most important lies elsewhere. Anyone nursing a loved one needs to suppress his or her own emotions and best interests. The nurse, then, stores up within himself a wealth of impressions that could be intensely emotional. He is providing himself with the material for a retention hysteria. So far, we've offered a surprising hypothesis. Charcot and Freud frequently misdiagnosed mercury poisoning as hysteria. So frequently, in fact, that the theories based on those cases simply aren't credible. Freud himself observed that most severe hysterics had fathers with syphilis, which was treated with mercury. We also noted Freud's remark that most severe hysterics shared a history of nursing sick relatives. And we've seen the scattered reports over 4 centuries of mercury's effect on caregivers as well as patients. Of 12 major case studies, in fact, such exposure is plausible in most of them. These seem to overlap in an unexamined way. Secondhand exposure to mercury as syphilis treatment and as antiseptic, and the similarity of severe, clinically defined hysteria to mercury poisoning is striking, from visual field constriction to gastric pains to numbness and paralysis and mental disturbances. Even the tussis nervosa and chest pressure shared by Anna O. and Dora look to us like mislabeling of a known effect of mercury exposure. Pneumonitis. To be sure, symptoms of mercury poisoning could be signs of other conditions as well. But if a patient came to a modern-day doctor with the stigmata of hysteria, for example, would mercury poisoning be one of many possible causes, or in fact, the presumptive cause itself? We can answer that with a fair amount of confidence. In the medical profession, doctors make use of a process called differential diagnosis. Patients don't present to doctors with diseases, they present with symptoms, and it's a doctor's job to use those symptoms, and particularly the most distinctive, as a diagnostic tool to hone in on the correct diagnosis. The hysterical stigmata have the virtue of being relatively specific, and some of the logic trees for doing differential diagnoses have been computerized and automated, and made available publicly. If you enter each of the three stigmata separately, sensory neuropathy, tunnel vision, and spastic paralysis, mercury poisoning shows up as a possible cause of each of them. But it's one of a long list. So we ask the question, what if you put the two most common stigmata together? We started by typing sensory neuropathy into the search field, clicked on possible causes, and 43 possible diagnoses popped up, including mercury chronic toxicity / poisoning. We then clicked narrow findings and typed tunnel vision into the search field. A single diagnosis was returned, mercury chronic toxicity / poisoning. This certainly strengthens a strong circumstantial hypothesis. Admittedly, it would be even more convincing if Freud actually misdiagnosed a documented case of mercury poisoning as hysteria. And indeed he did. What were those residues? In February 1910, Sergei Pankyayev had come to see Sigmund Freud. In time, he would come to be known in the psychiatric community as the Wolfman. Pankyayev was the scion of a family that held vast tracts of land in Russia and lived in not one, but two impossibly grand mansions down the road from each other, one for summer and the other for winter. Over the years preceding, Pankyayev had become increasingly incapacitated by depression, obsessions, compulsions, and physical dysfunction. A stay in a sanitarium recommended by Emil Kraepelin, who examined him in Germany and pronounced him manic depressive, did little to improve his condition. The name Freud gave to Pankyayev and the case study conjures a more exotic image than the facts perhaps deserve. Sergei recalled a vivid childhood dream in which a tree with seven white wolves on the branches appeared outside his bedroom window. Through an elaborate series of associations, Freud deduced that Sergei had, as an infant, witnessed his parents having intercourse. This, Freud believed, led to problems in childhood. By Sergei's description, these problems do not sound particularly catastrophic. Occasionally unruly behavior and fear of some animals. But those were the roots, Freud concluded, of the Wolfman's very real and debilitating adult difficulties. The Wolfman was Freud's longest case study, not only in duration, lasting 4 years plus several more months in follow-up treatment, but in written length as well. Many Freud scholars consider it his most notable case, showcasing the mastery of his psychoanalytic technique. Pankyayev's main physical problem was chronic and intractable, constipation. Essentially, Sergei's bowels did not move on their own. In fact, the assistant who was accompanying him in Vienna had two main tasks: to be the third player, along with Pankyayev's doctor, in a Russian card game similar to bridge, and to administer daily enemas. According to Freud, this physical symptom was a manifestation of hysteria. He wrote, "When later I came to describe the resolution of the patient's last symptoms, we shall see once again how his bowel disorder had placed itself at the service of the homosexual, expressing the feminine attitude towards the father." But here is an alternative explanation, and it comes from the Wolfman himself. In 1973, at the age of 86, he began a series of conversations in Vienna with the writer and journalist Karin Obholzer. It is by far the greatest trove of relevant personal information ever provided by one of Freud's patients. A key conflict between therapist and patient emerges from these overlooked conversations. For his part, Freud attributed the immediate onset of Sergei's adult problems to a case of gonorrhea. But of course, mercury might well have been part of that disease's treatment, which Pankejeff describes as prolonged and unpleasant. By contrast, the Wolfman discusses with Obholzer his own beliefs about the constipation Freud diagnosed as a symptom of hysteria. She notes that after his 4-year analysis, Pankejeff returned for several more months to clear up what Freud described in his case study as unresolved residues of his hysteria. Question: what were those residues? Answer: it's unappetizing. This is the way it was. I once had diarrhea, and Dr. Dronjes came to the estate in Russia. I tell him I have diarrhea. He takes a little bottle wrapped in paper from his pocket and says, "Take it." The result was that it got worse. Q. The diarrhea. A. The diarrhea. The next time I tell him that it didn't help, it got worse, and he says, "I didn't give you enough." Q. What was that medicine called? A. Calomel. Mercurous chloride. Q. Never heard of it. A. Later, a general practitioner told me that it is only given to horses, not humans. I am telling you that what happened was that I couldn't eat anything all winter long. I lived on tea, milk, things like that. Just a little tea. And I had to run to the toilet. It was terrible. All the mucous membranes were torn. And what happened as a consequence? The consequence was that these attacks of diarrhea stopped, but a new situation developed. Q. Constipation, I imagine. A. Yes, a constipation that nothing could be done about. When I took medicine, I got diarrhea again. I helped myself with those enemas that Freud then forbade. In the published case study of the Wolfman, Freud lays out a very different scenario, stating the bowel problem originated in childhood, continued into adulthood, and reflected early emotional conflicts. In discussing these disruptions to the function of the bowel, I have allowed my patient's later state of illness to take up more space than I had intended in a piece of work devoted to his childhood neurosis. There were two reasons for my decision. First, the fact that the bowel symptoms had remained virtually unchanged from the period of childhood neurosis to the later one, and second, that they were enormously significant in bringing the treatment to an end. And how did these bowel symptoms help resolve the analysis? Finally, I recognized the significance of his bowel disorder for my intentions. It represented the touch of hysteria that is regularly found to underlie any obsessive-compulsive neurosis. I promised the patient that his bowel activity would be fully restored, and then I had the satisfaction of watching his doubt disappear as his bowel began to add its voice to the work, as if it were an hysterically affected organ, regaining its normal function, which had for so long been impaired in the course of a few weeks. This does not comport, obviously, with the patient's own account. Not even close. Surely Freud would have learned during the 4-year analysis that Pankejeff himself believed his primary physical symptom was originally caused by calomel. Furthermore, Freud prescribed him medicine for it and told him to stop using enemas, so the onset of the condition was doubtless discussed. The patient also maintains that until being prescribed the calomel, his gastrointestinal tract had been normal, and that he didn't think talking with Freud for 5 years, including the last few months, devoted solely to the residues, had cured the problem. "I somehow got it to come by itself a few times," Pankejeff says in the interview with Obholzer. And he wrote, "We've been successful." No such thing. We're left with two possibilities. Freud either did not believe Pankejeff's own assertion that mercurial medicine caused the symptom, or he chose to ignore it. His intent, clearly, was to connect the problem to a much earlier and much different point, the childhood witnessing of a primal scene, followed by the dream that Freud placed at the heart of the Wolfman's diagnosis, treatment, and successful outcome. As with Anna O. and several others, Freud's claim that the Wolfman was cured by psychoanalysis was hardly substantiated by subsequent events. Quite the opposite. He continued to see psychoanalysts all his life for acute issues. The Wolfman provided far more information about his personal life and his experience with Freud than any other analysand. It's hard not to wonder what similarly detailed medical and personal histories would turn up in other cases. The circumstantial evidence for mercury poisoning is much stronger in several, Dora, Anna, Elizabeth, about whom we know far less. And the Wolfman reminds us of the many ways people in the late 1800s were exposed to mercury. We would never have suspected it in his case, if not for Obholzer's interviews. Interestingly, as hysteria died out as a diagnosis, so did mercuric chloride as an antiseptic. In the 1920s and 1930s, the toxic effects of mercurial antiseptics made them unpopular, and mercury ceased to be used as a syphilis treatment in the 1940s when penicillin replaced it. Most researchers attribute this demise of hysteria to what's called diagnostic substitution. Hysteria would now fall under conversion disorder, psychosomatic illness, or categories specific to the signs of mental illness the patient presented. But this attribution may very well be a misunderstanding of why hysteria really disappeared, based on a misdiagnosis of the true cause of many of its cases. What were the real-life consequences of this fateful mistake? A psychiatrist we last encountered in South Dakota was about to enter the fray on behalf of those who were paying the price. Mocking the Great God Unconscious. In 1940, Leo Kanner wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine titled, "In Defense of the Parent." By then, he'd been established at Johns Hopkins for a dozen years, his reputation rising as the dean of child psychiatry. The piece struck a chord, and inquiries from book publishers began arriving in Baltimore. Why did parents, and particularly mothers, need defending? In two words, Sigmund Freud. The onslaught of Freudian theory in America was gaining momentum, and mothers were assigned blame for almost every problem of their adult children, Oedipal conflict, oral and anal complexes, etc. Kanner came to Hopkins in 1928 and in 1935 wrote the landmark textbook, Child Psychiatry, a volume that deferred to Freud more often than not. But Kanner was a perceptive man, and he soon observed that Freud's influence had gone too far. As a child psychiatrist, Kanner frequently found himself in contact with mothers and fathers who felt themselves under assault. They could be blamed for everything bad that ever happened to their child. One misstep in a diaper change might arouse an infantile sexual urge that would echo for decades. One angry outburst during potty training might damage their child's psyche forever. Mothers, in particular, were on the defensive, since Freud's disciples, everywhere, held mothers accountable for every unconscious thought. Inevitably, mothers were deemed responsible for even the most serious mental disorders in their children. In effect, the establishment was taking Freud even further than Freud went himself. While he was certainly a mainstream psychiatrist, got along with his Freudian colleagues, and was influenced by Freudian ideas, Kanner found himself frustrated with this state of affairs. Judging by the interest from publishers following the Times Magazine article, he was not alone. The book that resulted, In Defense of Mothers, How to Bring Up Children in Spite of the More Zealous Psychologists, targets Freud head-on. One chapter, The Great God Unconscious, turns Freudian child psychologists into a joke, referring to the unconscious as GGU, or with a capitalized him. Kanner writes, "The myth of the GGU and his subdivisions has spread like wildfire. His religion is called psychoanalysis. His priests are people who have been initiated with long and elaborate rites. His altars are couches on which the worshippers, in recumbent position, are made to contemplate their spiritual navels 1 hour each day or every other day for a period of several years. Someday, when the GGU will have changed his residence from the textbooks of psychology to those of mythology, parents will no longer be bothered about his mysterious vagaries." In going after Freud, Kanner had effectively chosen sides in the long-running debate over the origins of mental problems, namely, what roles organic factors and emotional factors played in mental illness. He was landing, definitely, in the camp of Emil Kraepelin, with whom he crossed paths at Hiawatha, and his scientific, biological approach to mental disorders. But Kanner was ahead of his time, and Freud was about to reach the height of his influence. Dr. Spock wrote his first Freudian treatment of child psychiatry in 1938 and published his landmark volume, Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, in 1946, bracketing Kanner's defense of mothers. So while Kanner's common sense, empathy, and observational skills may have been right on the mark, the deeper truth skittered away like globules from a broken thermometer, ready to poison a whole new generation. This time, of children.